Hello, this is Thompson Smiley with the second of a series in which I take my Louisville magazine column, Smiley's Picks, on air. And my guest today is Bruce Simpson, the artistic director and fellow member of the Glasgow Mafia, who is artistic director of the Nutcracker. It's that time of year again.
Yes, it is, in fact. And actually, in fact, I did my first Nutcracker in Scotland in 1964, so we've been doing it for a pretty long time.
Yeah. It occupies an incredibly important place, not just in your repertory and your company, but in the whole nature of American ballet, isn't it?
I think that it's a great question, because I think that what's happened is that we have pantomime in Britain, you know, where every single city has a Christmas pantomime, like, you know, Beauty and the Beast or something like that. And they make it very topical to that city and that community. And I think since the demise of vaudeville in America, what's happened is American populations have taken Nutcracker to heart as almost a community celebration of the holidays. And, you know, you get 200 different Nutcrackers in America, and each one of them is completely different, and yet based on the wonderful score by Tchaikovsky and the choreography by Petipa from the original. But certainly America has made this into a holiday celebration, which is just marvellous.
And I hate clichés, of course, including that one, but it really is the show that has everything, isn't it? I mean, it's fantastic music. It's not just Nutcracker again. It's one of the great scores.
And also that what I think is absolutely marvellous, like I go into a shopping mall and you hear the music. You go into an aeroplane and you hear the music, and everybody plays it at this time of year, and you don't actually register that it's this glorious music by Tchaikovsky. But then when I walk into the studio to teach the ballet or to rehearse the ballet and I hear that music, I'm inspired every year all over again, because it is glorious and the choreography is glorious.
And it's a great story and involves children and all that sort of thing. Sure, a real family celebration.
Yeah, it's wonderful because, you know, like if you come as a child, it's magical and it's a fantasy. And yet if you come as an adult, it reminds you of the wonder of childhood. And it's also a safe bet for any family. It's completely appropriate for any age group and it's a guaranteed product.
I think that's one of the definitions of a masterpiece, that while you're listening to Nutcracker, you think this is the greatest music ever written by anybody.
Absolutely.
I mean, maybe you go home and listen to Beethoven, you think, well, you know, he's got much to commend him, but for the moment, he's a masterpiece.
Sure.
But also, is it not absolutely central to the financial health of your company and also of the industry?
I think most ballet companies in America, it's going to be a huge chunk of your yearly intake of funds.
It's some of the 68% of your ticket sales.
No, I don't think it's that much. I think it's about 25% of our total budget in the year. And certainly, it's a wonderful situation for us, because it also gives an artistic director like myself an opportunity to allow dancers to do all kinds of different kinds of roles in Nutcracker. We have five casts going on during this production because of the number of performances we do. We do 17 performances, including the student matinees for the schools. And so it does give dancers an incredible opportunity to pursue their art form, to try things that they might not normally get to do. And for an artistic director to examine his company and really provide opportunities to push the artists forward into their careers and give them a chance that they just might never have gotten otherwise.
I think that's a very interesting point. I spoke to a Russian ballerina, Amy Gray, who's in your company, was in your company about 4 years ago, and I asked, why on earth would anyone leave Russia, the home of ballet, in order to come to Louisville, Kentucky?
Yeah.
And her point was that in a company like yours, one gets many, many opportunities. A young Russian dancer might be told, you're a great Giselle and you're going to do Giselle for the next 25 years and nothing else.
And that's it. And also the thing is, like, for example, because they're state-run organizations, you go into the Corps de Ballet 18 and they may have 21 ballets in the repertoire, the great Petipa pieces. They might have Tales of the Bakhchisarai or some of the great Russian folk tales. But if you're in the Corps de Ballet, you're going to be stuck doing maybe six or seven roles for the rest of your life till you retire at 45. Now, in our company alone, we have something like 180 ballets in the working repertoire. Wow. It's just extraordinary. And so a lot of dancers actually join the Louisville Ballet because of the variety of the repertoire that they dance here, from Paul Taylor to Balanchine to Chusengo, you know, Valcana Paroli. And that really is part of the attraction of being a dancer in America, is the opportunities given to you.
And I hate to drag you back to financial matters, but excuse me, this nutcracker is appropriately called the Brown Foreman nutcracker because of a gift which is rumoured to be in the region of $1 million last year to create a brand new production.
Well, the big productions, for example, San Francisco's budget was $4.5 million. I stand corrected, but the new one that's being done at ABT at the moment is in the region of $5 or $6 million. And so to do a huge nutcracker in this scale that has to, and a large part of that investment goes into making sure that the production will last for 10 or 15 years.
And you use the word investment, which I think is very telling.
That's exactly what it is. It's, a, it's a generational investment. And for example, I can give you something that someone will really everyone will really understand. Normally, scenery is made out of wood and canvas. And what we did and chose to do this time is that we made the frames out of stainless steel. We then put drywall onto the stainless steel, and then we vacuum pressed the canvases onto the wood so it won't wrinkle and it won't tear. And therefore, as the years go on, there won't be that those incredible refurbishment budgets that you have to deal with. Yes. And so there was a great deal of thought put into the production in the sense that a lot of the costs are actually hidden. But there is an investment for a 10 or 15-year future.
Yes, you think 10 or 15 years is the the life of a production
Hopefully.
And that's not unknown in the opera business as well, where you know, a piece like Don Carlo has been, not this coming Don Carlo, but was in the Met repertoire for something like 25 years.
I remember in one of my old companies, I first did a production of Ashton's La Female Garde in 1970. And when I retired from the stage in 2009, many years later, those sets and costumes were still being used. Yes. We have costumes in our shop which were made in London 35 years ago and we're still using them. And it is that thing of also in the opera world where costumes, people perspire under all those lights on stage. You have to make it so that it's lined and so that perspiration doesn't damage the fabrics. All those kind of things have to be taken into account.
And that's why you talk about building costumes instead of sewing frocks.
Exactly, of course.
But the usual sort of attitude of what's the habit of talking down your own profession, they're sometimes referred in the opera business as frocks.
Yes, absolutely. And the thing is like also, but I think that's an Americanism in the sense that you build costumes in America.
Yes.
I'm always used to the word that we made costumes. So it's just that different
but
thing.
They are built in terms of layering of fabrics.
Of course.
And things,
certainly,
like that.
Certainly.
How much does a costume offer support to a dancer?
It's fantastic. I think it's the same as anything. There's no point in studying your whole career, taking 10 years to become a dancer, studying a role like Sugar Plum Fairy or even a snowflake or you know one of the gentleman roles in the ballet like the Nutcracker, and then you walk on stage and you're badly dressed and the costume's terrible. Then you think to yourself, and you can't move properly, then you think to yourself, well, why did I work so hard? And Peter Casley, the designer for this particular production, I've been working with him since 1972. He's an incredible international name in the ballet world as a designer, and he was a dancer himself. So he absolutely intrinsically understands the requirements and also choosing fabrics that are going to last for a long time.
And I go on at great length in my Smiley's piece about the number of sequins and the,
the cost
of
books. I'm sure there's more. It seems like there's millions in there.
Millions, yes. 1,000 sequins is a gross understatement. The elephant in the room, of course, of the Louisville Arts at the moment is the situation with the orchestra. And you've opened with performances.
Yes, of course.
Orchestrally accompanied, and the threat is that after December 15 you won't have that. But you've always done some performances with tape, have you not?
What's really interesting is that the Louisville Ballet performs often without the orchestra. There are certain things for, I can give a perfect example, is Valcano Pirelli's Lamborena, which is a score for African songs fused together with Bach. Now, you could never do that live, and there are certain scores that can't be done live. And so the Louisville Ballet really performs to the orchestra actually quite often. And in the past, we have done Nutcracker performances to recorded music. And so at this point in time, the information that we have is that we will have the orchestra up until the performance on the 12th of December.
Bruce Simpson, thank you very much. And the number to call for tickets is 584-7777 or visit louisvilleballet.org. One of the very few restrictions put upon me as a writer for the Louisville magazine with my Smiley's Picks columns is that occasionally my very accommodating and supportive editor will take exception to still another plug for the Met HD relays live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera to a multiplex near you, in our case, Stony Brook and Tinseltown. But I strongly believe that this now four-year-old institution, which is televised performances from the Metropolitan Stage, are the single greatest advance in promoting an understanding and a love of opera, in many ways the most elusive of all the art forms, the greatest development since the invention of the horn gramophone. But oddly enough, it's also among the least publicised developments, and I know people who are devoted to the performing arts, devoted to opera in particular, who have either never heard of or never been to a Met HD TV relay. This coming Saturday, December 11 at 12:30, there takes place what for me is really the highlight of the entire performing arts season this year, and that's a live relay over a period of something like 5 hours of Verdi's mighty opera Don Carlo. When I was director of the opera company, I produced Don Carlo, and the memory still resonates of it being a mighty undertaking involving huge orchestra, huge chorus, and a cast of principals, everyone of whom has to be absolutely on the top of his or her game. So Don Carlo is one of the titans of the operatic repertory, both in terms of its resources, but also in terms of its subject matter. There's a great tendency, I think, to think of opera as exotic and irrational entertainment and to be lacking in the sort of cerebral component, which is such an important part of, shall we say, Shakespeare production or chamber music. But in the case of Don Carlo, this simply does not apply. Verdi, I think, in Don Carlo, produces one of the truly great discussions, if you like, of what it means to be human and the nature of the human spirit. And if you go outdoors in the next few weeks and brave this dreadful winter weather for only one event, then let it be Don Carlo this coming Saturday at 12:30. You can just turn up at the cinema, but I would recommend maybe going online to metfamily.org and ordering your tickets to be sure of getting in, because some of these Met relays are now selling out all over the country and presumably all over the world. I can't really exaggerate the impact that they're having on the opera scene and how much they're contributing, I believe, to the fact that while most of the other arts are declining or failing, opera is the only one whose audience seems to be expanding. And talking about expansion, the Met began 4 years ago with, I think, about six operas, I believe, in 500 cinemas across America and the world. And I think the number now is nearer to 2,000 cinemas receive these live relay broadcasts. Well, what's the attraction? Well, number one, of course, the Metropolitan Opera is the world's greatest opera house. No opera company in the world attempts to do 7 performances a week to the extraordinary high standards that the Met achieves. No pit orchestra in the world, with the possible exception of Vienna, can match the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra when it's on form. And of course, the Met is also the most affluent opera company in the world, so spectacular scenery and stunning visual effects are part of the mix. Many of these can be lost for the ordinary opera goer who's restricted to buying inexpensive seats. I sometimes think at the Met that I'm in the wrong zip code to enjoy the performance. But with the relays, everything is up close and personal to an extraordinary degree. I mean, I believe that you hear the Met's orchestra better in Tinseltown than you do in the Met, because it comes through the agency of Dolby Sound and HD high definition sound, and it's a truly electric experience. Plus the fact, of course, you can see the faces of the singers, you can see the eyes, and as is axiomatic in the theatre, if you can't see the eyes, there is no drama. So for all these reasons, I find going to Tinseltown a more musically and visually exciting experience than seeing the Met live in New York. Having said that, I think there's also the excitement of knowing you are present, albeit by proxy, so to speak, at a live performance. And I was discussing in a break there with Ted Roskey the difference between seeing a live relay on a Saturday afternoon and going 10 days later to see the reprise of it, because there isn't the same sense that this is happening in my time, this is happening in real time. I don't want to get all spiritual and holy about it, but as you know, all theatre, including opera, has its origins in the spiritual, in the enactment for the benefit of originally primitive tribes and then for the Greeks, of the stories, the myths, the legends of their great heroes and of the gods. So there always has been a sort of sacramental element to theatre. And to see this acted out before you is a kind of spiritual experience. This is particularly strong, I think, in the case of Don Carlo. There's a fascinating study to be made among three different sources. One is the history of King Charles V, the Holy Roman Empire, his melancholic and troubled son, Philip II, and his still more troubled grandson, Don Carlo. These were all historical figures of the greatest import. And we still have a tremor of fear when we learn that Charles V was the one who sacked Rome in 1527, a real live historical horror. But Philip II was at one time engaged, believe it or not, to Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, and Don Carlo did in fact disappear under rather surprising circumstances. So these are all historical, living, breathing characters. Well, the story of Don Carlo and his father and his father's new wife was adapted by the German playwright Schiller, and he wrote a play called Don Carlo, and it was on that Verdi based his mighty masterpiece. And a mighty masterpiece it is. I mean, it's five acts in Italian. There's no such thing as the exact echt version of Don Carlo, because Verdi originally composed it in five acts in French for the Paris Opera House, and later it was revived in Italy, dropping the first act, and it was a four-act opera in Italian to suit Italian taste. Well, what the Met is doing, and Covent Garden, with whom this is a co-production, is a kind of patched-together job, in the sense that they're doing all five acts, but the five acts will be in Italian. And typically, of the Met, the cast for this production is pretty much a who's who of the world's greatest singers. You may not be familiar with the name of Marina Poplavskaya, but she will do the Elizabeth de Valois and has been earning rave reviews in London. Roberto Alagna is one of the top tenors of our day, and he sings Don Carlo. Simon Keenley's side is British. He'll do the Rodrigo, the Marquis de Posa, and the part of King Philip II, which is probably the greatest bass role in all Verdi, is sung by a great and demanding, commanding figure, Ferruccio Furlanetto. The Grand Inquisitor is played by Eric Halvorsen. The only thing I would add to all this is that of all Verdi's operas, this is the one, I think, which truly plumbs the human condition in a most extraordinary way. It concerns illicit love, it concerns friendship between men, it concerns the clash of politics with religion, the clash of church and state, if you like, impersonated particularly in a great confrontation between two bases, Philip II and Grand Inquisitor. I could go on for days talking about this, but I will just settle on saying, if you have to do anything on Saturday afternoon, make it Don Carlo at the Metropolitan Opera relays to either Tinseltown or Stony Brook. See you there. Thanks very much. My next guest is a longtime friend, somebody whose efforts on behalf of the arts, locally and nationally, I've long admired, and that's Ted Roskey, a former board member of the Louisville Orchestra, of Kentucky Opera, and of just about every other worthy performing arts organisation you could name. I want to talk to you, Ted, if I may, for a little about the situation with the arts in in America, maybe even internationally at the moment. I mean, we in Louisville are obsessed with the situation of the Louisville Orchestra and its recent filing for bankruptcy. When I say we're obsessed, that's everyone except the Courier Journal, who seems to avoid the issue most days. But this is by no means a purely local phenomenon, is it? I mean, we're not unique in our problems.
No, nor is it unique to orchestras, actually. Although among the performing arts, I think that orchestras have tended to have more difficulty in recent years than, say, ballet, opera, or theater. But
every, why?
I think basically it's the problem that we have here in Louisville, and that is that there's a very large fixed cost structure in the form of the musicians. And if you don't get the income that you're expecting to get, either through contributions or through ticket sales, it's very, very difficult to downsize your plant, as it were.
Yes.
Because you have employees that you have contracted to pay for the full year. And so with the ballet, you can move to smaller ballets if you need to reduce your cost structure. Or in the theater world, with which I'm most closely associated nowadays, you choose plays that have smaller casts.
Though even ballet companies have their challenges, don't they? Because in order to maintain a nutcracker-sized company, you might have 40 dancers, whatever the number is, on annual salary. So what you're saying is the name of the game is the overhead is just too large in many cases.
Unfortunately, yes. And in a number of cities, actually, orchestras have gone through great difficulties. There are several orchestras right now that are not performing because of difficulties, a gap in expectation between the orchestra musicians and what the institution feels that it can afford.
And what is why this current crisis? I mean, one hears that the mighty Detroit Symphony is in, once mighty, is in serious trouble, that even the Cleveland Orchestra.
And Philadelphia,
Philadelphia, two of the legendary Big Five American orchestras are in grave financial position at this moment. Why? Is it all the economy?
No, I think not. What happens in a horrible economy is that any institution that's sort of in a little bit of trouble gets in very deep trouble. And that's what we're seeing in the orchestras that you've just mentioned. The fact of the matter is the Louisville Orchestra has been in difficulty since the 1980s, when it took the giant leap of going to a so-called full-time orchestra. Previously, people were paid when they rehearsed and when they played.
Per service,
that's right, which gave a lot more flexibility. If we look at cities our size, I don't think there are very many at all cities of our size that have full-time orchestras. They're per service.
Mm-hmm. It's a human tragedy as well, isn't it? I mean, these players have spent their entire lives honing this craft and giving their all to it, and they now reach a stage where in certain places, I think their services are just no longer in demand.
Yes, it's sort of like, entertainment interests have moved so much in the last 25 years, whereas 25 years ago, a number of people took their entertainment in the form of classical music in a live concert hall. Nowadays, the competition for entertainment dollars is so much greater, ranging from the arena to the internet to, you know, just all sorts of options. And so I think all of the performing arts are seeing a trend toward fewer subscribers and more single ticket buyers.
I think you make a very important point that, in fact, there has been a huge shift in public appetite for the arts. 25 years ago, when I was involved actively in running an opera company, if I said to you, do you like music? You'd have said, well, yeah, I like Mozart and Beethoven and Brahms, but, you know, some of this, you know, we'd be talking about classical music. If I said to a person nowadays, say, in middle-aged person, do you like music? They wouldn't reply with the names of dead European white men. They'd be talking about Lady Gaga and And it's not just Louisville. Again, I mean, the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, on the eve of the opening of the Met's Don Carlo, you would have expected Don Carlo splashed over the front page of the art section. Not at all. It was a rap singer and, you know, his problems and challenges.
Well, and New York has the luxury of having several reviewers for each and every art form. In Louisville, we really don't have any local reviewers left that are dedicated to reviewing an art form.
Except popular music. Jeffrey Lee Puckett, I think, is about the only one. How damaging do you think it is to the Louisville art scene then not to have a full-time music critic on our paper of record?
Oh, it's a fact of life. I don't really know. I think more and more people are getting their information via Twitter and Facebook and other social media through the internet. So I'm not really sure. But what I do know is that in Louisville, we have been blessed with a lot more arts than any other cities of our size. Of the cities that have the four major performing arts groups plus a museum, I think there are only 12. And Louisville is by far the smallest of the 12. Mm-hmm. And so what's happened is we've gotten used to performing arts in general of a very high caliber and have always felt, oh, things will work out. You know, I don't have to dig any further into my pocket or do anything more to support what we've got. And simultaneously, we've lost all of our large companies. And so certainly the corporate support base is greatly diminished.
Oh, yes.
And we just really haven't been able to set any priorities as to what do we want in terms of the arts and how will we ration the resources available to pay for them.
It seems to me, but then I may be bigoted on the point, that of the arts, the one that seems to be flourishing or closest to flourishing is opera. I mean, I see all over the country opera companies in trouble, and every month or so one is either totters or falls. But generally speaking, the appetite for opera seems to be holding up remarkably well. Why do you think that is?
Well, you've got all the elements of entertainment. You've got your visual, you've got your music, you have drama. So it has a fairly wide appeal. Although I would say that the theater is pretty universal also. Mm-hmm. So those two, I think, are the art forms that are probably the most accessible.
Yes, but it's been through the theatre has changed radically, hasn't it, in the last 25 years? I mean, the well-made play, which runs for 2 years on Broadway, is a thing of the past, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And for large cities that can afford it, if you have a big name, that helps sell the required number of tickets.
Yes, but even Brad Broker will tell you that a very good small Broadway show will not sell. It's only a handful of the big blockbusters. You might even say the Aida Bohème and Carmen of Broadway.
Absolutely.
That will sell year after year. So name recognition has always been a factor. Now it seems to be the factor.
Yes, either the name of the actors or the name of the work. Well, the ABC.
The name of the work. And Actors Theatre still continues, I mean, to be preeminent, I think, among American repertory theatres. So we have much to be proud of in this
city.
Absolutely. Do you see any hope of a reversal of this, if the economy returns? Or do you think the shift in public taste is so marked that we're going to be facing a different landscape in the coming decades?
I'd love to think that we could get back to where we were, but I don't really think so. For the reason you mentioned, if the public doesn't want to buy product, then you're really facing an uphill battle as you try to sell that product.
Well, thank you very much, Ted Roskey, for that perspective, not just on Louisville's art scene, but on the art scene nationally. Thanks very much.
You're welcome, Thompson.